Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mole. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields.
Today, we are ending our three-month journey with Shannon Hill. Thank you for being here. So today we're going to talk a little bit about language and using language and writing in your books and just how you guys use that tool. I know, Brandon, you talked about trying to get what's in your brain onto the page and never being satisfied with how successful you are in that. Just talk to me a little bit about language and where you are with language and how you use it and how what you want it to be.
Okay, so at the end of the day, I see my job as being creating a good scene, creating a moment where something happens, right? And I'm creating that moment out of words. To me, it is endlessly challenging and sometimes endlessly frustrating to try to take a scene that seems really cool in my mind and to build it out of words. But it's also so satisfying when I read it done well or when I do it well. And sometimes what stays with me after I read a book I like is really just a few really good scenes that really grabbed me hard. And trying to figure out how to make those kind of scenes happen is like my Don Quixote quest as a writer. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to find that. I'm trying to figure it out. So yeah, I'm excited to hear some of Shannon's thoughts about it. And I'm happy to share what I'm learning and trying to learn about it.
Yeah, Shannon, I know specifically one of the reasons Brandon wanted you on this podcast so bad was because you are such a beautiful writer and your prose.
Oh, writer. Okay.
Yeah, I just, and individual.
Just eye candy.
we wanted you just for the eye candy on the podcast is why you're
Because that's you're why here. We do
yeah,
podcasts.
Yeah, that's why maybe. We do radio, right? Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your approach to writing and using language.
At our heart, we're storytellers.
Right.
But there's a lot of ways to tell a story. And so the reason to become a writer is because we use words. We could paint pictures, we could sing songs, we could do, you know, make movies. There's lots of ways to tell a story. I heard someone once say that in order to become a writer, you need to be in love with sentences. And that has really stuck with me because I never thought before that, like, am I in love with sentences? And I realized, yeah, I am.
Those periods are pretty hot.
Like, I do. I love a sentence. I love a good sentence. And that's the art form of writing prose, is coming up with sentences and then using them to build stories. The weird thing about it is there's not really anything you could teach anybody mm-hmm. about how to do that. It's not like a technique. You can learn how to fix an engine of a car, although I'm sure there's creative aspects of that too. But there's not hard and fast rules about any of this. So much of it is just, it feels right. And so in order to train yourself into being a writer, you read a lot so that you get a sense of what feels right to you. And then you write, and then you revise a lot until you're tweaking everything to make it feel right. And ultimately, what you're trying to do is use these, you know, words, which are symbols. It's just so meta. Like, there's so many layers of weirdness to what we do. These symbols on a page that represent sounds, that represent words and ideas, and to create images and emotions in a reader. And it's so weird because I grew up doing theater, and you could perform and you could actually feel the energetic exchange between the actors and the audience. And you could feel live if they're receiving it, if they're with you, if they're getting it, and you adjust your performance based on that feedback. You don't have that when you're writing. You're working alone and you're having to be the reader and the writer constantly to make those words evoke images and emotions in the right sequence.
Yeah, so we're plucking something out of your brain, placing it in my brain through the medium of letters and symbols.
But it will never be one-to-one, of course, because your brain is full of different experiences and associations and connotations than mine is. So no one ever reads the same story the same way.
Yeah, you mentioned a room, and my brain creates a room.
Yeah.
And then I hear facts about that room from your writing, and the room will change, but the structure is still what I created in my mind and will never look like what was in your
head. And that will affect how you receive it, because you may have associations with the room that you were using as a template from your childhood or whatever. My best friend from childhood, her house is in so many books that I've read. I don't know why that would. Have you ever been reading, though, and they give a detail of what a character or a place looks like, and you're like, no. like, I'd already been picturing it differently. Don't mess me up.
You check that. You discount certain. Yeah, I've done that before. Well, it's funny. It makes me think of that meme. There's like a meme that I saw not too long ago where it was like, the difference between Gandalf in the movies and Gandalf in the books is, in the movies, Gandalf looks like this. And there's like an image of Ian McKellen as Gandalf or whatever. And then in the books, he looks like this. And it's just the typed word Gandalf. Oh.
That's so good.
And it's like, yeah, that's the problem. That's
that's amazing.
And it's also kind of the opportunity that we can take, that somehow Tolkien gave us that typed word Gandalf, and talented people were able to say, yeah, maybe it looks like this wizard in Fellowship of the Rings that an actor brought to life in a way that was very convincing and interesting, and helped a lot of people go, oh, that's actually kind of cool. Like that hadn't put in the work with the book, right?
Well, I think that reading is a creative process, because we're creating. I always say that writers do like 50% of the work and the reader does 50% of the work. And you have to leave space for the reader. You can't micromanage what everything they're seeing and taking from it. You've got to leave space, oxygen to flow through it, so they have room to make up their own story. Yeah. But one thing I love about movies, and I do love movies, is that you get to see what someone else saw when they were reading the book.
Yes. Mm.
So it's like, oh, that's not exactly what I saw when I read it and experienced, but I'm seeing someone else's versions, and that's really cool too.
Yeah, and sometimes you're like, wow, that was a really cool way to picture it.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're like, wow, that was a terrible way to picture it. And that's subjective too, right? Yeah. But sometimes it's really thrilling when you're like, oh, that's not how I saw it, but the way you saw it was really cool. Yeah. Like, and that's with art, with a movie. It is such an interesting challenge to think of, like, I'm going to try to write code that will run in the computer of your mind.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And produce an experience. You know, when you think of it that way,
who thought this was a good idea?
It's almost maniacal.
This seems like an impossible task.
Yeah. But it's also so thrilling because you've experienced someone else's code coming into your mind and lighting you up like a Christmas tree, where suddenly you're in this world and you're seeing this world and you're like, so grateful it exists.
Yeah, and the code is more than just the language too. Like, it's the genre that creates some of the code for you as well. Like, if you take a story that takes place during Christmas time, like, a lot of that code is already inside you.
Right.
And you know what that means, and that work has already been laid for you, and then you can just build on top of that.
With it, or you're working against it. But either way, you have to be aware. Yeah. So that's one reason why writers tend to be well-read, is because we have to be aware of the stories we're working in concert with or against to create surprise.
Shannon, when you mentioned you're a big reader, are there any authors where you love them just because of their beautiful prose and not really so much their stories or anything like that? Does anybody come to mind where you just, anything they write, you just want to consume?
Because of how it's told? Like, I don't care what story they're telling, but how they tell it is so beautiful that I want to hear that voice in my head.
Everyone I'm thinking of, I also enjoy their stories.
Well,
so,
you can't pick them then.
Yeah.
No, you can.
I love a beautiful, like, just a really evocative writer, and there's so many. But there are other ones, they're writers who are not necessarily lyrical, and I'm not caught up in their prose, but they're really good at telling a story, and I'm still right there with them.
Right.
And then there are other writers who the style of their prose prevents entry for me into the story. And it's not, and that doesn't mean that they're a bad writer, but it often, what I have found actually is writers that I can't read very well are ones that actually write too similar in style to me, but a little bit off. And what happens is my editor is trying to fix the sentences, you know? So I can't enjoy
it. Is it almost like the Uncanny Valley at that point?
Yes.
Where it's like a weird version of you that you're looking at?
And then it becomes work.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, if I was what I'm used to doing, because I do this so often, I do many, many drafts of my many books. And so when I'm reading something that reads like that, I'm like, I got a keyboard under my fingers and I can fix it. But when I'm reading the book like that, I can't fix it. And like, I'm stuck in frustration.
That's funny. Brandon, what about you? Who are some of the beautiful writers that you enjoy?
Like, one of the authors where I first started noticing, like, man, I really like this style was Vonnegut. Like there was a style in Vonnegut that was like satirical and like, it was like factual, but funny. And like there was just something he had going on where I was like, oh, I wish I could do that. And then there was like, but then there's like Ursula Le Guin, who like for me, like had some beautiful things she did with language where I was like, man, like I wish I could describe like her. Like, I wish I could think of the original details that she was seeing and like, where is she pulling from to get these original details? Sometimes calling something a mysterious thing in the room looking like a clot of shadow or, you know, just really interesting language that helped me see something in a fresh way. And so, I mean, I guess one of the things that when I think of her, that her writing helped me think about was, and there was a BYU professor, I went to school at BYU, and there's a professor who said that the essence of poetry is juxtaposition. And when I pondered on that line, that the essence of poetry is juxtaposition, taking some things that are seemingly kind of unlike, but putting them together in such a way that we're forced to ponder why they
see
are
it in
like
a new way.
And that the combination of A plus B suddenly equaled something that A didn't have and that B didn't have and that maybe no other description would have had. Sort of like how I'm a dude and you're your own dude, Jason. But when we're together, we have a certain kind of rapport and relationship
right.
that I don't have exactly with anybody else. That there's this third entity that's mm-hmm. us together. That's sort of what's happening here is with the right juxtaposition of ideas and details and words, we generate something new that's more than the components, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's always like thinking of it as the essence of poetry helped me think of, oh, juxtaposition might be really important for evocative description, right? And so like when I'm trying to like, I write best from my gut. I write best when I'm in kind of a flow state. But when I try to do the math of it, and how is this good? Or how do I get better? One of the things I think of is like, okay, when I'm writing something, what is this like? Like what are some comparisons I can make to this that may not seem obvious at first, but what is it like? Like trying to find an interesting clot of shadow kind of description,
you know? Shannon, what about you? When you're crafting these sentences that you're in love with, how much time do you spend per sentence?
It varies, but recently I was revising a novel that I had revised several times, and I went back to the first page, and I spent a week just the same thing happened, but finding new ways to say it. I didn't think it would take me a full week every single day, all my writing hours every day, over and over and over again, trying to find the right words, because the first page is so important. So much of it for me is about the verb. So the first draft, so first I outline and get the idea of what's going to be happening. And then when I write a first draft, and it's really common for me that not a single sentence in the final draft will be the same as the first draft. But I get it down. And then so much of revision for me is figuring out what is happening and why it matters and all the little connections in there. And throughout the time, I'm thinking about the way I'm telling it. But those final drafts are all about the way I'm telling it. And so much is hunting down the right verb. Because it is writing from your gut, because you've got a feeling of what it is, and you're not sure what is that word that's going to give the reader that feeling. And sometimes it's a word that, you know, the wind blew. We know what that means. And sometimes you want it. You want a sentence that just says the wind blew, because there's nothing else you want to say about it. You just want to know, the readers just know that the wind is blowing. But there's other times where you want to give what the character is feeling when that wind blew. And if you use a verb that you may not normally hear, the wind shattered through the trees, the wind clomped Sounds like that has a lot of gravity implied. You know, you try different verbs because you're like, I want you to feel a way you haven't felt about the wind before, so you know what the character is feeling. And when you're feeling what the character is feeling, there's going to connection there. You're going to care about the character, and the story is going to mean more to you. So those little choices that help a reader feel what the character is feeling is how you make a story matter.
Can you overdo it, do you think, where every sentence you're crafting to the point where it's just muddying the waters? Or do you write in that style where you try every sentence is, what am I adding to this?
Every sentence, yeah.
Every sentence.
Well, the goal is not to fill it with thesaurus words. The mm-hmm. goal is just to make a great sentence. And sometimes that sentence is very simple.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you have to use extravagant words or tell it in a way no one's ever told before, but it is finding the right combination. Yeah, I do look very carefully at all of it. I write shorter books too, and that is, you know, a picture book or an early chapter book, the kind of thing that you're trying to evoke in that. Some of the books I do are going to be read aloud by parents to their children 2,000 times in 1 year, so I've been told. And I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking, I read it out loud because it's not just how it looks on the page, it's how it's going to sound. Are the words going to feel good in mm-hmm. the parent's mouth? Are these two words, even if they're the right words, are they going to be hard to say together?
That's probably the kindest thing you could ever do to a mom is write a book that's easy.
I mean, I have four children, and yeah. Man, I read some books so many times, and there's few that you kick under the couch because you're like, I cannot read that book again.
My mouth can't do these gymnastics.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
You should write a book where you can skip multiple pages and the children won't notice.
Ooh,
do that.
Like, that's a billion seller. Yeah,
any page is skippable.
Where it all makes sense.
And it still
there
makes sense.
There were books that I could read with my eyes closed, and because I was so exhausted that, but I had to read to the child, and so I was happy when they picked one that I could literally. I didn't even have to open the page turn, and those were my favorite.
Yeah,
yeah, where you knew it by heart. Like for me, I know with the picture books that I had to read with my kids, I was always glad if they were there weren't too many words. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if there was a lot of words per page in a picture book, that was a little bit like,
you're like, come on, man.
Oh man. Okay. let's shoulder this.
I gotta spend time with my kids and do homework. This is the worst.
Yeah. But yeah, it's some of the stuff you're saying, Shannon, you know, like that idea of, do the words convey the experience the character's having, right? That's a very healthy thought. Like I remember realizing, you know, as a fairly young writer, realizing like what happens is one thing, but the character's reaction to what's happening is the story, right? Like yeah. how the character feels about it, the experience they're having, if that can be conveyed, that's the story. And so, you know, it's cool that there's a sunset, but the way you describe the sunset can color and help the reader understand how the character is viewing the sunset. And therein we have character revealed, we have mood established, and that's all words, right?
Yeah. Otherwise it's just events.
Right.
We go from this event to this event to this event, and we're not seeing how any of your characters are being impacted by those events. Yeah.
It is an interesting challenge, too, to then try to find the music of the dialogue of each character.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, because there is, it's akin to hearing a certain kind of song that you know how to sing. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's a music to each character's dialogue if you get to know the character
well. The goal would always be to be able to read a piece of dialogue without a tag on it and know who said it.
Yeah,
like you know the characters so well mm-hmm. that you know how they sound.
Yeah. So you're balancing your voice in the novel. You're balancing each character's voice and making a difference.
Well, you're balancing the narrator's voice. Because that may not necessarily be our voice. Because you may have it, even if it's a you know, third-person narration, different books I would use different narrators. Mm-hmm. They might have different sensibilities and different styles. You know, when I write comedy, that narrator is going to sound really different than a narration for, you know, a sweeping fantasy.
Yeah, yeah. Brandon, you mentioned you're working on your novel with the Satyrs right now, Duel and Norn. I said that wrong.
Nulandorin. Yeah, you flipped it. Good job.
tell me a little bit about going back into those characters that you're so familiar with versus writing you're also working on your other novel right now, where these are brand new characters that you are discovering as you write. Tell me the difference between writing those two satyrs versus these new characters that you're working on.
It's easier to write a character that you know really well. I mean, that would be the way to sum it, sum it up. But like, my wife will sometimes catch me if I'm writing a character and I go into what she might call like a default voice.
Oh.
Like, oh, you're kind of phoning this character in. This is sort of a default voice. I know this voice. I've heard it before. And actually both the women I've been married to have called me out on it when I do it. So I know it must be a chronic problem that spans more than one marriage. and when they do, it's like, I just feel like I got caught cheating. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
it's like,
maybe you get a third wife who just likes everything you do.
Oh my gosh, that sounds like paradise. You're so brilliant, Brandon. Say something else. Write something else.
Oh, it'd be awful. It'd be the death of your career.
It would be a nightmare. Yeah, it'd be a nightmare. No, I'm so grateful to get called out. Like any of us writers, when an editor is right, we're so grateful because that's going to make us look better and smarter than we showed up with than how we showed up that first try, right? When I write Newell and Doran, I have a feel for them because I've had them say lots of things and I know who they are. And because inside my head and heart, I know who they are, I can speak for them a lot easier. It makes me think of when I used to write comedy for Divine Comedy. I would often write for the actor that was performing the character because I knew what kind of stuff Marin could sell. I knew what Sean could sell. And so I'd have my friend Sean's voice in my head as I'd write certain stuff. And when I did it that way, it would often be really good. And also it was stuff that he could then tweak and improvise with because it was already kind of in tune with him, right? And so like that kind of thing is what I'm doing with a character that I know well. And if it's a character I don't know well, I have to put in more time. And some of that might be more drafts. And some of that might be just more daydreaming and spending time with them in my head. But the better I know them, the better I write them every time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have characters, Shannon, that you are just so familiar with that writing for them just feels natural?
Yeah. When you get to know a character really well, absolutely. You just know there's so much more problems. So much of writing is problem solving. Mm-hmm. And there's just fewer problems that you have to solve. You know what they would do and what they wouldn't do. You still have to find the right words to convey the images and emotions and the events and everything else. But that, it can be really fun. We wrote a couple of books about Marvel's Squirrel Girl, and we already knew her from the comics, so that was really fun just to jump right in. We already had a voice that writer Ryan North had helped establish for the comics, and we adored his writing. So it was almost like variations on a theme. Like, we get to take this character that a lot of people hadn't in, but especially Ryan, and run with it in our own way. And that, it was so fun. And she was optimistic. She was such an optimistic character, and my husband is not. And he said writing those books was like therapy, because being able to see the world through the point of view of such an optimistic, happy person, it was like joyous.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's a fun part about inhabiting a character, is it does help you see the world in fresh ways. Like, I have had so many thoughts and realizations because I was inhabiting a fictional character's point of view, and I saw something that I wouldn't have seen myself, but because I was being the Sphinx in Fablehaven, from that point of view, I realized that patience mimics the power of eternity. Patience mimics the power of infinity. A thought that never would have occurred
to me, right? Until you became the Sphinx.
Until I was inhabiting that character. Yeah. And that's a joyful part of the process.
Shannon, when you work on your first draft, how much effort are you putting into that versus just story? Is the first draft, you're just, hey, I'm trying to get the story down and then I'm going to make it beautiful? Is that, tell me your process.
I am just trying to get the story down. But the greatest joy of writing is just coming up with a perfect sentence. So in order to keep fueling that energy that I have for creation, I'm not going to stop myself from, if I feel like my energy is saying, spend some time on this sentence and get it right, I'm going to do that, even if I'm not going to make my quota of how many words I need to write that day.
Are there sentences that you have memorized that you're so proud of that you can just pull out?
Oh, man. I wonder how many sentences I've written. I mean, 45 books. I don't know.
I couldn't do it either. It would be pretty hard.
No, mm-hmm. I don't go back and reread my books necessarily, unless sometimes when I'm writing sequels. Actually, usually I'll listen to them on audiobook to like remind myself what I've written before. But and there are many times when I've written like the perfect sentence and then later I've had to cut it because what's happened has changed. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, but you know what? The way I console myself is like that sentence had its audience and that audience was me. And that's I beautiful. Got to enjoy it.
Yeah,
and
then yeah.
And the reader never knows it was there and will not miss it.
Yeah. The will not miss it part is sometimes hard to realize.
Yeah.
You know, because you miss it.
Because you feel like there's something missing. Like, oh, no one else knows that, though.
Yeah. To anyone else, it's just a non-thing.
I remember I had to reread Princess Academy one time because I'm writing the sequel like 7 years later. I was like expecting a scene and it didn't happen. And I went, oh, I cut it.
Oh, see, that's funny.
It was still in my brain. I had been there. It had been there for so many drafts that I was still expecting it. I was like, and then I remind myself, no one else is missing it.
I will have this experience occasionally where I don't sit down and reread my whole books mm-hmm. either because it's just, I've spent so much time with them. Yeah. It's hard to do. But like sometimes I'll catch a piece of one I'll be fact checking for, you know, I'm writing a book in Dragon Watch and going back to Fablehaven to make sure I'm not contradicting myself. And every now and then I'll run into, especially like a joke where I'll go, oh, I'm funny.
Yeah.
I go, oh, that's like,
that's the best feeling. It's for like, sure.
That's a pitch perfect joke.
Yeah, no, for sure. The comedy, nothing's more satisfying.
And it's partly a pitch perfect joke. Because it's my sense
of
humor.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? So
it's like,
totally.
It's like me having forgotten I was writing for an audience of me, and at least one guy thought it was hilarious.
Yeah. That's right. I have people on the regular quote my books to me, and I'm like, and I have no idea it's from my books.
Yeah. Oh,
and they
funny.
Think I would know. And I've had people show me tattoos of quotes from my books. And I have to realize from context that it's probably something I wrote. And that's why they're
right,
showing like, it to me.
Did I write that?
Because I truly, and I don't even know what book it's from. Even if I think I probably wrote that. And then I'm like, what book was that? I'm trying to ask leading questions because I don't want to crush them to know. I don't have my books memorized. I don't know.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time on them at the moment. And I knew them really well while I was writing them. By the time a book comes out, I've written other books mm-hmm. since then.
I've got a question for you, Shannon. So
lay
like,
it on me.
There came a point for me when I went from worrying most about what is the word to worrying most about what is the detail? Like, what is the detail I'm trying to convey? And because realizing like sometimes I would get so caught up in the words that I didn't like go back and go, well, what's the best details that would get the reader there?
And so you're kind of like reverse engineering.
Like, and now that I found like, what's the detail? Like, what is true about this scene that's odd or different or interesting? And once I found the detail, then find the words. Mm-hmm. 'Cause sometimes you find the detail through the words. You know what I mean? Like the words lead you into the detail. Have you run into thinking like that? Like for me, it became, I think right now, most of the time, if I'm stuck, I'll go to, okay, well, what are the details? What are details that are interesting about this moment or being noticed in this moment or make this?
Do you have a specific example of, or could you make up an example of what that would look like?
It's the same thing with Shannon's good sentence. Like if we opened a book of hers and she went through it, she could find a good sentence in a few minutes, but it would be taking
a few
time.
Seconds.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
Chock full.
Well, I mean like
crack a page open, dude.
I mean like one where you're like, this one's heaven. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like this is 99th percentile Shannon Hale sentence, you know, thinking about the details. I'm in a swamp. Mm-hmm. The character's underwater in a swamp. What do they feel? What's there? What's even there? You know what I mean? And like almost on that one, I had to do a little research and go like, what's underwater in a swamp? You know what I mean? What is the, is it fibrous roots? Is it a muck that's soft? Is it, are there little bioorganisms? Like what is there? Right. And so it's like, first I need the details. I don't know what's there. I could fake it and just say it felt oily or, you know what I mean? Like I could fake it with words, but I find sometimes doing a little hunting for some details yields something that I didn't even know that I could have described there. You know what I mean? Or like, right. I hadn't.
That's where research is your friend for sure. But also, I ground myself in the senses. So when you're trying to find the words that make a feeling.
Yeah.
And so when I'm stuck like that, I often would be like, okay, so often what we default to as humans is, especially people who have sight, are what do things look like? Because that's our primary sense if we have sight.
Sure.
And so often when I'm reading, I noticed this first actually when I started working with young writers, is their stories are descriptions of what characters see. But when you're really in life, even though sight is our primary sense, we're taking in so much more, even if we don't think about it consciously.
Right.
We are smelling, we are feeling, we are tasting. And there's also an energetic kind of feeling that we describe as emotions. And so in order to get a reader to feel a way, we want to understand what the character is feeling. And that character is taking in a lot of senses. So it would get real tiresome if every scene you're describing the five senses. She tasted this, she heard that, you know. That. So you figure out what is the whole experience in that swamp. What is the character experiencing through all the different senses? And then what are the key ones that are going to help transmute that feeling to the reader? And then what are the best words to help evoke that in the strongest way?
Yeah, that was a good summary. That was a good peek.
Way better than you did.
It was a great peek. Way better. And a great peek into the thinking that lets you get some.
But what's funny is I think one reason why it's kind of fun, like writers love to talk about process and craft together. We do it when there's no microphones. And one reason why I think we do is because we're not thinking about how we're doing what we're doing when we're doing it. We're just doing it. And then you talk about another writer, and by hearing what they do, either you're like, oh, that's what I do too, or I do something different. It helps you realize what you do. Because so much of this is like kind of from that, you're in the flow and you're doing it intuitively. And I'm not having a checklist of how to write a book. And I'm checking, have I done these things?
You don't have a manual that you're following and going through.
I don't. Sometimes I wish I did.
Yeah, you should write one.
It would be terrible.
Well, and here's the truth. You do have that checklist, but it's deep inside and instinctive and intuitive. And it's merged with you.
And
we
talked about that with the hero's journey, right? Like you're not checking off the hero's journey as you're going, but that template is in your brain and in your soul and comes out in your writing without effort or thought.
Yeah. It's just part of...
It's the metaphors of the subconscious.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I have a question. You talked about making yourself laugh at your own jokes. Have either one of you made yourself cry?
Oh, all the time. Embarrassing amount. When I got my MFA and I had to read for your thesis defense, you read a short story. And I choked up while I was reading my own story. And I lived with the shame of that forever. And so I decided I'm never going to do readings. And then with my second book, I just would do talks. I wouldn't read from my books. But with my second book, someone surprised me. The audience question, they said, will you read part of it? I'd love to hear authors read. So I was like, okay. And I just opened the first page. I started reading and I choked up. And I don't think I've read from my book since. I know, it's so embarrassing. Like way more okay to laugh at yourself than like cry at your, you know. And now I just know I'm a very sensitive person. I cry all the time. I cry very easily. I read aloud. I'm paying my children to read my books because they won't otherwise. My 13-year-old daughter is upstairs right now reading one of my books. In order to get her to read it, I read the first chapter to her aloud yesterday. And guess what, Jason? Guess what I did?
Niagara Falls.
I had to stop because my throat choked up. But then I also know that I'm feeling it, right?
Sure.
And I also wrote it. This story is for me, you know, first and foremost. So if it doesn't affect me emotionally, then I'm like.
And does it, not just when you're reading it, but as you're writing it, are you getting those moments too?
I actually avoid writing in public. Because I am so emotive while I'm writing. I'm like making facial expressions and I'll say things out loud and I'll do things to be like, how do you describe this gesture?
I totally, like, here's what's funny is sometimes I will write and Erlyn is in the room, Erlyn, my wife, and she will catch me doing funny things with my hands or doing like weird expressions. And she's like, wait, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm acting out the thing.
Can you not see what I'm doing? What is this word? Yeah. What am I doing?
Yeah. I am a crazy person that you married.
It's worse even when I'm writing like comics and graphic novels because it's such a visual medium.
Oh, yeah.
So I really am thinking about how do I describe to the artist what the person, what it looks like, yes. what the character's doing.
You know, I've read one script for a comic book once, and it felt like just a personal letter to the illustrator.
Right, yeah.
Is that your experience when you're writing?
There is no standard format for writing comics and graphic novels, mm-hmm. Unlike screenplay, which is very much a meticulous format. Everybody follows the same. For me, it depends on if I know the artist or I don't. So an artist I've worked with before and I know well, that's the script is for it. You are writing, when you're writing a novel, you're writing for the reader.
Right.
When you're writing a script, you're writing it for the artist.
Right.
And so you want to give them enough information that they can draw, you describe each panel, what's going on. Like most of the script of a graphic novel, the reader doesn't see,
mm-hmm.
you know, the dialogue and the captions or narration or whatever. And then the rest of a description panel by panel of what's happening. So I might be like, you know, when I think this one should mirror that one panel that in book one where this was happening, or maybe an aerial view, or but something what we're trying to get away is that she feels small in
this scene.
You know? So yeah, absolutely.
I think the one I read even had like I forget the artist's name, but the writer was like, Ryan, right here I need you to do this, or you know, yeah. It's very just.
We
very
could talk
personal,
about their yeah. strengths or like, yeah, you know how yeah. you do really cool yeah, creatures? Yeah, 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 make yeah, a good yes. one, like yeah, make yeah. a weird one.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. Do you like writing for graphic novels
yeah,
versus?
I love it. Yeah. I love it. There's just so many readers that are visual thinkers, and it really is, I mean, it's just a lifeline for them. So I think they're so mm-hmm. important. But also for non-visual thinkers, it kind of helps them think visually. They're great for everybody. But also it works a different part of my brain
mm-hmm.
and my brain gets bored easily. So I'm always trying to challenge myself. I think that's one reason why I do a lot of different styles and kinds of books and genres and age groups. And graphic novel really does work a different part of my brain than writing prose.
That's awesome. And that's personal for me too, because I was completely illiterate until I was 15 years old. Could not, I was such a slow reader that by the time I finished a paragraph, I couldn't tell you
yeah,
what
you
the
forgot
paragraph.
What happened
yeah,
before.
I had no idea, and because of that, I for the first 15 years of my life, I felt like I was dumb. I felt like I was stupid, and that my opinions matched my stupidity
yeah.
and other stuff.
It affects your sense of self worth, but it wasn't you. Nothing wrong with you.
Yeah.
You just didn't have the right books for you.
Yeah, and so yeah, so I appreciate that thought of like, hey, I want to create stuff that. It's more accessible for other people, and it kind of blows my mind. I've had several like surreal experiences, like when Brandon sends me a manuscript and he's like, "Hey, give me your thoughts on this, and is this working?" And I'm like, "Why is he asking this stupid kid who doesn't know how to read how you know his thoughts on a book?" And it's funny just how life just kind of. Happens that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're still haunted
yeah,
by being
for
this,
sure.
this guy that
part
was...
of you still sees yourself in that way and
oh,
to realize
for
other
sure.
people don't see me that way. Maybe that's not
yeah,
the totality.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk
am.
About your love for sentences and you describe finding the right verb, I hear that word verb and it puts me into to like first or second grade where
oh.
they're explaining it and like my brain is just not absorbing what it means and being
yeah.
confused and looking around at all these like kids who somehow get it and yeah
feel
so
stupid
it,
look
yeah.
at you now
yeah,
talking about verbs
and now I've used verb in a sentence and everything today.
You know, I want to say when we talk about the perfect sentence, I don't mean that it necessarily needs to stand out as though it's a piece of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So the perfect sentence is the perfect sentence in the context of the paragraph that it
right,
appears
right,
in.
Right, right.
It does its job
in terms of the whole story, so it doesn't necessarily mean that it's like poetic or whatever, that it's going to be something that people are going to inscribe on stones above mausoleums.
Right, right.
It just
or
means,
tattoo
ooh.
On their body.
Yes, or which could happen. But for me, like a perfect sentence could be three words long, and I was like, oh, that perfectly summed up what I was doing, but with a gentle twist in a mm-hmm. way that is mm-hmm. so satisfying.
Yeah.
That's what I mean by the perfect sentence.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
That's
awesome.
Yeah, a sentence that does its job.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And sometimes it's a descriptive sentence and sometimes it's a line of dialogue and
yeah.
it's like, that's so him or that's so her.
Yeah, yeah.
Or that's exactly what they would say in this moment. And that can feel really rewarding.
What about when you guys are writing books and you have to include lyrics to a song that you're writing or right. a poem that, you know, outside of your yeah. genre, but is it within your book or a yeah. puzzle or, you know, yes. some sort of something like that, a rhyme or something. Tell me about your experience.
Yeah, that's very unnerving. So in Princess Academy, I wanted to give a sense of, it's a fantasy landscape, and I want to give a sense of the culture of the village where she's from. And one piece of culture is the music or the songs that they have. So I decided to start each chapter with a piece, like a stanza from a song that would just bring you into the culture of the place. And it was fun and challenging in a different way. And when it came out, someone referred to him as poetry. And I was like, oh, no, I'm not a poet. I'm not trying to be a poet. Like, I have this idea of, like, poets are really fancy and smart people. I was like, I swear, I wasn't trying to be a poet.
Oh, I've never worn knickers in my life.
Like, I don't have a beret. I don't know what you're talking about. So I felt really self-conscious about that. And then eventually when I wrote two more books, like, many years later in that series, I was like, well, I dug myself in a hole.
Yeah.
Because now I got to do it all over again.
I've got a beret and everything.
But there are moments where you're like, I am not smart enough. To write what needs to happen here. Like, I think puzzle twists, those kinds of things, or if you decide a character is like super smart and then you're like, but I'm not, so how do I fake this?
Insert mathy expression. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's smart enough not to talk much.
He knows no one wants to hear his math stuff.
Just trust me, he's smart.
But yeah, scientist.
In fact, erudite.
Yeah. For me, I never felt more like I had become J.R.R. Tolkien than in, like, Beyonders when I had, like, a song in a tavern. I was like, it was almost like a bucket list thing. Like, there's going to be a song in a tavern.
There's going to be a map. There's going to be a tavern
song.
Yeah,
there'll be a map. And the song's not going to be super long because I didn't like it when they were too long.
Yeah.
It'll probably rhyme, but not well.
Yeah, it'll be a little. It was more like it had the feel of, like, a shanty kind of song. Right. You know what I mean? I was like, maybe that I can do.
I can rhyme through repetition. That's what it's going
to be. Yeah. But very fun. It's fun to try to pull off anything like that where you're a little outside of what was comfortable in that story and that, oh, now I got to create something else. That's very fun.
Yeah. Do you do that also with phrases that other like fantasy creatures would use in their culture, and you're making up phrases or making up, you know, turns of speech that,
I'll give you one example. So in Five Kingdoms, I had a character who was kind of like, he ran a slaving ring of kids, right? Like, so he's not a friendly character.
He was making these
kids steal stuff from sky castles for him, right? Like, basically is what was going on. But for that character, I was like, he makes up his own words. Like, he just makes up words that sound true-ish.
True-ish.
But they're not like from their culture. They're not from their society. He's just, to him, he sounds smarter if he makes up some of his own words. Mm-hmm. And I never explained that at all. But it was really fun to like see how many words that aren't words can I, you know, if he talks about something that's elongified or something. How many words can I find where I can kind of hopefully like maybe like my goal was like maybe some people won't even know it. Like maybe some people won't notice that might be a word, you know, but if you track it, I don't do that in anywhere else in the book, but for that one character's dialogue, he makes up words. And to me, that kind of thing's kind of fun.
That's cool. Shannon, have you made up words?
I'm sure I have. Yeah. There are many school children in the world who are upset at me because they've had to research Linder, a rock and a Miri flower and discovered that they don't exist. Like, oh, sorry.
Yeah, it was a fantasy creation in your fantasy world.
Yeah, because I did a lot of research on stone quarrying, and I needed my particular stone to have certain properties that could be lightweight enough to travel down mountains without too much infrastructure. And I was like, well, I'm just going to have to make one of them because I don't want the stone quarriers to come back to me. And it's like, those wagons wouldn't have been able to haul marble that far. And I'll be like, oh, no.
It wasn't marble.
It was linder, of course. Yeah.
You often get little veins of mithril in the linder.
That's awesome. Well, good. I think we should wrap up this episode. Any other final thoughts about writing beautiful prose or using language or inventing words?
I mean, the best language is what does its job, right?
Yeah, trying to make it do its job, trying to find a detail that evokes something for you. and then trusting that it'll evoke something for someone else. At the end of the day, that's sort of what we're trying to do.
Awesome. Some games I've played with myself in the past have been, I will, just for fun and inspiration, before I start my writing day, I might read some poetry of, you know, someone else, and then notice some words that I don't use very often, mm-hmm. and put it on a post-it note on my computer, and like challenge myself to use those words in my writing today. And then you end up using them in an interesting way that you wouldn't have otherwise. I may not always keep them, but it's a fun game.
That's fun in a very nerdy way that totally syncs with me. You know what I mean?
Like, it totally tracks with what you know of me.
It tracks with what I know of you, but it tracks with myself too. It just makes me think of so many times I've done things of that sort with vocab. Like, really trying to make sure
it's fun for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Brandon, why don't you tell us about any projects you're working on? Or?
Oh, yeah. So coming out pretty soon, we'll have an Adventurer's Guide to Dragonwatch. So we did a Caretaker's Guide to Fablehaven, which is an illustrated encyclopedia of that story world. And with my Dragonwatch series, I expanded the Fablehaven universe so much that we have made an Adventurer's Guide to Dragonwatch, an encyclopedia that focuses on the dragon sanctuaries, has a ton of art from Brandon Dorman, which is part of the best thing about it, I think. And lots of little details, including things from the books and stuff that goes beyond what has been shared before, like naming what the five elite swords were and, you know, things that were like left a little bit off the page, putting some names to some of those things. So that'll be coming out in October, and it should be cool for people who like such things.
Awesome. Shannon, do you have any fun projects coming up?
It is the 10th anniversary of Princess in Black, mm-hmm. and we have book 11 coming out. It's the Princess in Black and the Kitty Catastrophe. She gets a pet cat. What could be better? And my very first board book, part of the Itty Bitty Kitty Corn series called Things That Go.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and for the 3 months straight having you here. You are our first guest on Mulling It Over with Brandon Mull, and hopefully someday you'll be our first reoccurring guest. So appreciate you being here.
Yeah, thanks, Shannon.
Thank you.
Hey there, fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second. We don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all of the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.